Merci Colette, merci beaucoup d'avoir accepté mon papier. Donc, je vais parler en français. Le titre de la présentation, c'est l'intégration sans dessus-dessous. Sans dessus-dessous, c'est un bon exercice de prononciation, sans dessus-dessous. Mais c'est surtout une expression qui signifie un état de trouble, de confusion extrême. Et c'est une expression qui convient tout à fait à l'état d'esprit des journalistes de Radio-Canada et CBC au lendemain de l'intégration. Donc, l'intégration des équipes journalistiques, ça s'est passé à l'automne 2009 et l'automne 2010. Les journalistes de CBC et de Radio-Canada ont vécu la fusion des équipes d'information radio, télé et web. Et cette intégration ouvre la voie au travail multiplateforme où un seul journaliste alimente les nouvelles télé, radio et web avec un même reportage. C'est un changement de culture majeur pour des journalistes habitués à travailler pour un seul média, et c'est justement ce que CBC et Radio-Canada veulent créer. Ils veulent créer une nouvelle culture journalistique en modifiant la structure organisationnelle, et puis l'idée, c'est de distribuer la marque Radio-Canada sur toutes les plateformes. Et donc, CBC et Radio-Canada suivent le mouvement de convergence globale des médias qui est entraîné notamment par les changements technologiques. Ce que j'ai constaté dans ma recherche, c'est que le travail multiplateforme provoque le mécontentement des journalistes dès les premières expériences de journalisme multiplateforme. Je parle trop fort, trop proche. A radio girl who speaks too loud. Donc, le travail multiplateforme provoque le mécontentement parce que les journalistes trouvent qu'il manque de temps, qu'il manque d'expertise aussi pour certaines plateformes. Ils détestent modifier leurs méthodes journalistiques qui sont éprouvées. L'attention accaparée par les contenants plutôt que les contenus les distrait beaucoup. Ils se plaignent de l'homogénéisation des reportages et de leur dépendance plus importante aux sources d'informations. À tout cela s'ajoute l'exaspération de certains journalistes radio. Ils se plaignent que leur média d'origine est négligé. Ils craignent la perte de spécificité du journalisme radio, le non-respect des caractéristiques uniques de ce médium léger, de proximité rapide, qui exige une narration propre à l'oreille, à l'oral, et qui fait une large place au son et aux ambiances. En fait, des journalistes radio devenus journalistes multiplateformes constatent que les reportages télé leur prennent tout leur temps et leur énergie et que la radio devient un média de seconde zone. Et parce que quand il faut alimenter radio, télé et web, évidemment, la télé et son besoin d'image, la télé et sa lourdeur s'imposent tout le temps au détriment des autres médias. Et les récriminations de ces journalistes trouvent un écho dans d'autres entreprises de presse qui pratiquent la convergence ou qui ont réalisé l'intégration de leurs équipes journalistiques. L'approche multiplateforme où les journalistes deviennent des jack of all trades fonctionne difficilement en général. Et ma proposition, c'est que l'intégration ou la convergence peuvent être abordées différemment. Une façon originale et productive, selon moi, de modifier l'approche de l'intégration, c'est de conserver l'aspect multiplateforme du travail journalistique, mais de conserver les cultures d'origine. Donc, on va avoir des journalistes audio, des journalistes vidéo, des journalistes texte, plutôt que des journalistes multiplateformes radio, télé, web. Ainsi, l'expertise de chacun des journalistes est mise à profit. Les distributions multiplateformes sont assurées et l'impérialisme culturel télé, on pourrait l'appeler comme ça, est aussi maté. Imaginons par exemple une journaliste audio. Elle peut préparer du contenu pour la radio, pour le web, pour les services numériques, en travaillant avec son mini-disque, en profitant de tous les avantages associés à la légèreté, à l'intimité de la radio. Elle va toujours baigner dans sa culture audio. Un journaliste vidéo peut maintenir son identité de journaliste télé, continuer de travailler avec un réalisateur et un caméraman, mais distribuer ses images et ses reportages télé sur toutes les plateformes, donc continuer de jouir de l'impact fort des images, continuer aussi d'être un expert de l'écriture qui accompagne les images. Même chose pour les journalistes de l'écrit. Donc, les praticiens deviennent des journalistes audio multiplateformes, des journalistes vidéo multiplateformes ou encore des journalistes écrits multiplateformes. Et l'idée, encore une fois, c'est de mettre à profit l'expertise de chacun plutôt que d'en faire des néophytes du multiplateforme. L'idée, c'est aussi d'ouvrir des nouvelles possibilités d'exploration journalistique. Donc, le journalisme multiplateforme audio, vidéo ou écrit, ça permet de modifier les formats journalistiques un peu figés puis de découvrir des façons inédites de livrer l'information. Parce qu'avec les nouveaux formats, c'est ça les explorations qu'il faut faire, d'après moi. Et la voie est ouverte pour des pratiques journalistiques émergentes pour trouver des nouveaux modes de narration de l'information, des nouveaux modes de récit. Autrement dit, pour trouver des nouveaux codes journalistiques. Et c'est une façon de redonner du pouvoir aux artisans des médias plutôt que de fractionner leur travail, de fractionner leur identité. Les artisans des médias, là, ont du pouvoir sur les technologies, sur les méthodes, sur les procédés journalistiques. Ils peuvent manœuvrer, trouver des façons de faire nouvelles, établir des nouveaux réseaux de relations selon leur expertise. Donc, ils peuvent batailler sur un terrain qu'ils connaissent bien. Plusieurs auteurs sont une source d'inspiration pour cette réflexion que je propose, notamment des auteurs qui ont réfléchi au format journalistique, aux façons de raconter, aux moyens d'éveiller l'intérêt des auditeurs et des internautes, aux façons de les surprendre, de les déstabiliser. Vincent Giret dit justement que à travers l'Internet, nous avons à trouver des nouveaux modes de narration de l'information, des nouveaux modes de récit. Ça, c'est le mode de narration traditionnel, donc très formaté pour arriver à présenter une nouvelle. Donc, des idées pour réfléchir à ces nouveaux formats, ça pourrait être de s'inspirer de Géraldine Moulman, qui propose de se pencher sur l'esthétique du choc. Inspirée par Benjamin, elle dit « La réflexion benjaminienne sur l'esthétique du choc, caractéristique centrale de l'art moderne, constitue un idéal critique très fécond pour penser la pratique journalistique. Donc, elle propose de pousser la curiosité journalistique à bout dans la recherche permanente d'un point de vue neuf, improbable, où le journaliste oscille entre le détective et le badaud. » Cette esthétique du choc fait aussi penser au texte de jouissance versus le texte de plaisir de Barthes. Selon Barthes, le texte de plaisir, c'est celui qui contente, qui donne de l'euphorie, celui qui vient de la culture, qui ne rompt pas avec la culture, qui est lié à une pratique confortable. Donc, ce serait ça, le texte de jouissance. Mais le texte de plaisir, lui, il met en état de perte, il déconforte, il fait vaciller les assises historiques, culturelles du lecteur ou de l'auditeur. Et ça met en crise son rapport au langage. Donc, quand je dis qu'on peut s'inspirer de ça, ça veut dire qu'on peut penser qu'on peut livrer l'information d'une façon différente. Et ça va faire en sorte aussi que l'auditeur, le lecteur ou l'internaute va avoir accès à une information il va avoir une façon différente de vivre l'information. Donc, où mènerait une telle quête, une telle recherche de l'esthétique du choc, du texte de jouissance journalistique? C'est difficile de dire, mais c'est vers ça qu'il faut aller. Beaucoup d'artisans interviewés dans ma recherche sur l'intégration à Radio-Canada, justement, trépignaient d'impatience à l'idée d'essayer. Donc, il y avait un petit recul face à l'idée d'intégration, mais une fois qu'ils se font à l'idée, là, ils ont envie d'essayer des nouveaux formats, des nouvelles façons de faire. Il y a un journaliste radio qui disait « Moi, j'ai des projets web, je veux faire des trucs multimédia avec des photos, du texte. » Et des cadres aussi de la salle des nouvelles disaient « On a le droit de faire des erreurs en ce moment, on est chanceux, on a plein d'opportunités, on est dans une période de révolution, il faut essayer, il faut expérimenter. » Donc, quand on ouvre la porte à l'exploration, qu'est-ce que ça peut donner? Moi, je propose de s'inspirer des réflexions d'artistes sonores pour alimenter la recherche de nouveaux formats, de nouveaux produits. Un des buts des artistes sonores, c'est justement de défier ou de défaire les formats convenus. Anna Fritz de Montréal est un bon exemple. Elle dit qu'elle veut défier les formats conventionnels, to challenge current conventions and restrictions in terms of form and content. Un autre artiste, Winnestern, dit que la voix radio traditionnelle, ça cache des structures de pouvoir insipides en plus d'être ennuyeux. Donc, on essaie de faire ouvrir ces formats, de modifier la voix radio traditionnelle. Et leur approche, leurs explorations pourraient amener de l'oxygène au journalisme audio. Il y a d'autres inspirations qui peuvent venir des artistes Fusco et Gomez-Pena, qui mélangent les langues, qui force les structures des langues à s'ouvrir. Eux, ils parlent Spanglish ou Inglenol. Donc, ils mélangent les langues et ils disent « What we are actually doing is healing the language by forcing it to open its structures. » Donc, c'est ce genre d'idée-là, je pense, qui pourrait alimenter les nouveaux formats journalistiques multiplateformes. Je pense que l'information contenue dans les sons, les voix, les intonations, les rythmes, les hésitations, les répétitions peut aussi amener la création de nouveaux produits journalistiques. Est-ce qu'il y aura de l'espace pour ce genre de proposition dans les entreprises de presse? On a entendu plus tôt dans la conférence Groundwire qui joue avec des non-narrative formats. Moi, je pense que c'est ça qu'il faut beaucoup mousser dans les salles de journalisme, pas seulement dans le journalisme alternatif, mais aussi dans les salles de journalisme traditionnelles. Moi, je pense que le talent, la créativité des journalistes ne font aucun doute et selon des chercheurs, la survie des entreprises de presse réside dans les explorations, dans Innovation and Storytelling. Jane B. Singer, qui a beaucoup étudié la convergence dans les salles de nouvelles, elle encourage ces explorations. Elle dit que suite au mouvement de convergence, les journalistes vont trouver des nouvelles façons créatives de faire leur travail en se redéfinissant comme professionnels et en redéfinissant leurs pratiques. Elle ouvre la porte aux explorations que je viens de décrire en parlant de convergence et de divergence pour illustrer les jumelages qui peuvent être faits, les complémentarités de certains médias, les incompatibilités. Donc, c'est dans l'air, mais je crois qu'il faut pousser ça plus loin. Ultimement, ces explorations pourraient mener à de nouvelles identités journalistiques et l'étude de l'intégration ailleurs dans d'autres entreprises de presse montre justement l'émergence de nouvelles identités journalistiques. Par exemple, beaucoup de journalistes hybrides qui sont mi-journalistes, mi-experts informatiques apparaissent. Je sais que ça intéresse beaucoup mon collègue Jean Huguerois. Donc, on les appelle des server managers. Ils sont une sorte de new species of editorial worker. A sort of hybrid of journalist and computer expert. Quinn a remarqué de son côté l'émergence de news resourcers, des journalistes responsables de faire de la recherche supplémentaire pour ajouter du contenu au reportage, qui sont des journalistes rédacteurs, recherchistes, un peu secrétaires de rédaction. Donc, c'est des journalistes qui ont des talents de bibliothécaire et de gestionnaire de l'information. Ils peuvent ajouter du contexte et de la profondeur à un reportage. Ils peuvent aussi trouver dans les réactions des internautes, ce qui mérite d'être fouillé quand il y a potentiellement une source de nouveaux contenus. Alors, tous ces journalistes hybrides peuvent être, tous ces nouveaux rôles peuvent être bonifiés, modifiés pour ouvrir la voie à de nouvelles identités journalistiques, dont, par exemple, les journalistes audio, les journalistes vidéo, les journalistes texte que moi, je propose. Et ça forme une nouvelle culture qui est un peu le but de l'intégration. C'est ce que disait Jennifer Maguire, qui a présidé l'intégration à CBC. Elle a dit « We're forming a new culture ». Et donc, c'est une réflexion qui a été inspirée de Radio-Canada et CBC, mais je pense qu'il va intéresser toutes les entreprises de presse. Merci beaucoup. J'ai une pièce audio. Si vous voulez avoir un exemple de ce que je veux dire, je pourrais la présenter dans la période de questions si on a du temps.
Right, we're in business now. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here today and for inviting me to present my research. As Colette mentioned, my name is Sneha Kulkarni. I'm currently a reporter, print and television side for Sun Media, and before that I was with CTV in Calgary and in Toronto. But today I'm here to talk to you about some interesting research I did for my master's degree with Royal Roads University. And my research is essentially a case study of the G20 in Toronto and the role of social media. Now, I think in the past few years, we've all been faced with the social media question. Do I really need to be on Twitter or Facebook? And what am I getting out of social media as a journalist? And those are questions I had as a working journalist. And I can say without a doubt, social media is a force that we can't ignore. And one of my favorite descriptions, am I too loud? Sorry. One of my favorite descriptions of social media is that it's a force that allows people the power to participate. And for me, that's a lot of what journalism is about. You know, engaging the public and giving them the information. Sorry. All right. Giving people the power to engage the public and give them the information they need so they have the ability to participate in society. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the picture on your left. That is, of course, the miracle of the Hudson. And that was a picture that was snapped with an iPhone by a regular citizen on a ferry. And that was the picture that was the first piece of news, the first way that information was spread about this event, and it came from an ordinary citizen. And of course, in Egypt and Tunisia and many of these other Middle Eastern countries, we've been talking about Facebook and Twitter as launching pads for the revolutions. Now, when it comes to major events, people are using social media as a means of voicing their opinions, following an event, and gathering reaction. And the G20 in Toronto was no different. Now, in my research, I set out to answer two questions. The first is, how does social media impact the ways in which journalists and citizens experience breaking news? And secondly, how can journalists better adapt their news gathering skills to incorporate all of this information available on social media while still upholding journalistic ethics? Now, just to give you a little bit about my methodology, I looked at Saturday, July 26, 2010. I used the Google Archive system, which sadly does not exist anymore, but through that system I found 460 tweets under the G20 hashtag. Now, I looked at a specific time frame, a 4.5-hour period, because to me that represented a breaking news event. We had a peaceful, very large, but peaceful protest march that ended with a great deal of chaos and violence. Now, before I go into the findings, I want to discuss some of the main theories I looked at. There seems to be these two distinct camps within journalism: those who feel the news business is being threatened by the cult of the amateur, and those who see collaboration with online communities as a route to self-preservation. Now, Pamela Shoemaker's gatekeeping theory was central to this. She suggests that journalists are awarded power to filter through the information and decide what people should be reading in papers or seeing on the news. On the other hand, we have ambient journalism, which is coined by Alfred Hermida. He argues social media is changing the way people experience current events. And there are many other new media scholars like Mark Poster and Henry Jenkins. They argue the media hierarchy is shifting, and access to technology gives viewers and citizens the power to participate in the news gathering and publishing process. So let's get back to those 460 tweets I had the pleasure of going through. My first question, of course, was, why are these people tweeting? What are they getting out of this? And I categorized the tweets, and I found that 60% of those tweets in my data set focused on sharing information about the event, sending out links, updates, and pictures. And for me, this shows that Twitter was a front line for people looking for information in a breaking news situation. People were using Twitter like a community newswire. And what I found particularly interesting was the collaborative effort. In some cases, one user would post a question: is the Eaton Center on lockdown? Can I get to the mall? Or someone else, apparently that was a concern for some. For example, another would post, who are the Black Bloc? And incredibly, within minutes, you would see answers to those questions. You know, people were actually going out there, they were doing the research, they were finding answers and retweeting those who were looking for answers. And remember, this is all being done in a four-hour window in real time. So with all of these engaged citizens doing their own research, spreading information, you might ask, what about the journalists? Where do they fit into all of this? And interestingly enough, I found that journalists still maintained an authoritative voice, even in the Twitterverse. At first, there were a few differences between what eyewitness citizens on the ground were posting, pictures and updates, and what the journalists were posting who were on the scene. But as the timeline progressed, more and more citizens began publishing or republishing what mainstream news outlets were reporting. So essentially, they were monitoring the mainstream media. Now, users seem to be scanning news websites and 24-hour news channels and posting the information they were hearing or reading. For example, one tweeted, CBC TV reporting less than 100 violent protesters out of a total crowd of 10,000. And of note was the Toronto Star and the National Post. Their accounts were very frequently retweeted, and they really focused on quick bursts of information for people who were trying to get around the city of Toronto. For example, the Eaton Centre was locked down. Protesters now outside police headquarters. That came from the Toronto Star Twitter account. So while there were plenty of citizens on the ground who were posting these eyewitness pictures and information, there still seemed to be an unspoken authority for news organizations, and there was great interest in what those news organizations were saying. And for me, this corresponds with a study done by Paul Farhi in 2009. He found that Twitter users are extremely engaged in the news. In fact, his study showed that Twitter users are 2 to 3 times more likely to visit a news website than non-Twitter users. So that's why I think this demographic is so important for us as journalists and for news organizations. Now, the other thing I looked at is how exactly does social media affect the way people experience a breaking news event? Specifically, how does it shape their views? Now, what I found was changing sentiment and opinions throughout that four-hour period. In the first hour of my data set, there was this great sense of pride that was out there. A lot of people participating in the protest, a lot of their supporters were tweeting on this hashtag. For example, I'm proud to be a Torontonian today. And someone else tweeted, what's the difference between soldiers and protesters? One is a state-sponsored fight, the other is not. Both are heroic. And that's just a snapshot of that sense of pride that I saw. Now, while these two people were not necessarily talking to one another, they were connected to a community of like-minded individuals through this hashtag. And Alfred Hermida describes these link-based posts as both a form of data sharing, but also as a system for creating shared conversations. And while this only exists online, this is a public space online, it does help to frame what human-computer interaction researchers describe as an understood reality. Now, as more information and pictures flooded this hashtag, the sentiment really changed. And for those of you who watched the coverage or were in Toronto, you'll know there were police cars set ablaze, storefronts smashed, and that's when messages like these began popping up. Tossing journalistic impartiality aside, I'm ashamed to be Canadian today. Violence is not the answer. Toronto lost its innocence today. And this was at the height of the violence. And these comments indicate a collective response of frustration from both journalists and everyday citizens. And this changing sentiment wasn't just one or two tweets. What I saw was a cascading effect, a display of the evolution of opinions among Twitter users on this hashtag. And this presents what I think is an interesting example of social capital created by online communication. Maybe familiar with Robert Putnam, a political scientist, he suggests that dense networks of interaction broaden a person's sense of self, developing an I into a we. And he was referring to community groups, but I think we're seeing the same thing through social media and online communities. And this really does reveal in my mind that online discourse does help shape and it does impact a person's mental portrait of an event. And that's, I think, important to consider as a journalist, because we want to not just report on the event, but capture the sentiment of the society. How are people reacting to an event as well? And I think those who are talking online cannot be ignored. It's also, in my opinion, that it appears that the hashtag that within the hashtag, the legitimacy of information and opinion is increased as more and more people retweet a post. And this follows the law of network, that the value of a network exists in the square of the number of users. So essentially the power of Twitter is in the number of users, and I think we've seen a lot of examples that display that in the past few years. Furthermore, if online legitimacy is based on, quote, shareability of your comments, I think journalists can't assume that a professional affiliation guarantees them a sense of authority. I think it appears that opinion makers or leaders online are those who are constantly active in sharing and discussing ideas. So go figure. Social media requires you to be social, not just tweet headlines. So in all of this, what does this mean for journalists trying to navigate the social media world? Well, in my opinion, despite what past researchers have written about, I don't think social media is making journalists obsolete. I think it's changing the profession, without a doubt. But with so much information available out there, I think the question is not about gatekeeping or even who's minding the gates of information. It's who can make sense of all of the information. Now, Hermita describes journalists as, quote, sense makers. And I agree with that because I think reporting the news, it's not just about reporting the event, but making sense of all of the information, not just in the physical world, but also on the online world. And certainly this collaborative atmosphere we see online, especially through social media sites, can be used to foster greater community engagement for newsrooms. Now, firstly, most newsrooms do have a social media presence. They have an account, or journalists have an account, but I think this breaking news event shows that there needs to be a true social media strategy specifically for breaking news events. How is the newsroom going to connect with those who are talking online during the event? Not a day later, not after the events happened looking for reaction, but at the time, in real time. And having this plan in place, I think, can help with research for stories, certainly, but it can also potentially connect us with new audiences and give them a vested interest in seeing the finished product, the final report or the news article. And certainly it shows us that that 6 p.m. news deadline may be somewhat arbitrary and not the only deadline we should be working towards. So certainly one of the greatest challenges presented by new media or social media is not the greater power given to citizens, but I think the greater demand and expectation. I want it now. They want information now, and it's not about waiting until the paper comes out tomorrow or the 6 p.m. news. So we need to learn how to deliver to those new demands. And finally, I think some will argue that technology makes us more isolated. That argument certainly is out there, but I think that social media shows us a way in which we can encourage connectivity and at the end of the day, enhance our final work as journalists. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
While we're setting up, just a minor housekeeping note. Just want to draw attention to a sheet of paper in your kit, in your bag, which is a survey for a multimedia course or a digital reporting course at Carleton for mid-career journalists. So kind of a marketing survey, I guess, from Jeff Salad. So please fill out the form and bring it down to the registration desk downstairs. Yes.
It's not the greatest PowerPoint, so if it comes up, you guys might be disappointed.
Oh, there it is. Yeah, there's the bulbs on now. It wants to go.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, I'm just going to begin because really, I don't know if it'll enhance things that much. I'm sure it will. Anyway, my name is Karen Owen. I am a working journalist. I work at CTV Calgary now. I also a sessional instructor at Mount Royal University. And I guess in Sneha's presentation, Hermita says, I am also a sense maker. So perhaps that's what I am. I don't know. I wanted to just share my personal experience about the challenge of collaborative storytelling in our local newsroom in Calgary. And I'm defining collaboration as a partnership between the traditional journalist and the citizen journalist. The challenge, of course, is to determine how that relationship works. Casual conversations, organized discussions like this, one about citizen journalism or participatory journalism, often has left me with a sense that my job is going to go away soon. In fact, the entire newsroom I work in is in jeopardy. We're on our way out, and we're going to be replaced by citizen journalists. And so am I redundant? Could I be replaced with someone armed with a smartphone? I would like to think not, at least not yet. However, I would suggest that collaboration is definitely impacting the way we do our jobs. We are more responsive, I hope, to citizens' input. We're paying attention to what citizens are saying. However, we are not relinquishing control of what we are saying. Now, we have always had news tips coming into the newsroom, and I've been around for a while. So it used to be by phone and sometimes by letter in the mail. Perhaps you're familiar with those. I couldn't even find an artifact like that to bring. Now we're really inundated with it. Email, Twitter, Facebook, the phone. And as Jenkins suggests, consumers are empowered by shared knowledge. The citizens do know a lot. And we can find out a lot. Therefore, we cannot wait to act. Sometimes we used to maybe put a story, well, we can do it tomorrow. We can certainly not do that anymore. That is if we want to maintain our role of providing timely information. We have to respond to the incoming communication quickly. However, even if we, and this is a local newsroom, remember, so if we're getting a tip about a highway closure, or we get detailed emails about an apartment infested with bed bugs, it doesn't necessarily make it to air right away. We still have to do the proper checks and balances. Andrew Keene suggests in today's culture, the audience and author have become one. I'd maintain that's not, in fact, the case. In the world of local news, the audience and the author are still separate entities. In spite of the ability of viewers to offer up information with a click of a mouse, we journalists still have an obligation to maintain standards. So I believe journalists are not redundant. There is, in fact, good research to suggest consumers to continue to get and trust news from traditional sources. And this actually speaks very nicely to what Sneha had presented about the Twitter followers starting to go to the traditional news sources during the G20 difficulties, shall we call them. We are constantly reminded that we are held to a higher standard by the viewers as well. You know, those news tips that come in all the time, they also come in, there's complaints. They like to point out our errors of fact or grammar or incorrect video references. All fair game. They absolutely should. But to me, that just sort of shows they are holding us to a higher standard. Now, many traditional newsrooms continue to follow Bruin's three stages of journalistic process, input, output, and response. And in the CTV newsroom in Calgary, the input and output is generated by traditional journalists. The output is offered in many ways now, the daily newscast, website, Facebook, Twitter. Input from citizens comes in the form of video or written content, but it's still carefully screened, it's fact-checked and edited, and this format, I dare say, is followed at most other TV newsrooms in Calgary. The only obvious response, back to Bruin's three stages of journalistic input, comes through our website, Facebook, or Twitter, but even then, we do manage that content. We're not going to put up any hate or any swearing. Other than that, we you know, it's fairly free, but we do manage it. But if all this sounds like traditional journalists are failing to change or embrace this new participatory model, this is not the case. What is clear is that professional journalists must find a way to balance the demands of the new media ecology without sacrificing the standards that our profession tries to achieve. Now, often citizens do become news sources during breaking news, such as extreme weather events. For example, in the midst of a recent huge windstorm in southern Alberta, citizens were emailing us, alerting us to a huge grass fire. It was fanned by the wind. It resulted in a mass evacuation. Now, this email certainly required confirmation with traditional authorities like the local fire department and RCMP, but this was the impetus for sending a crew out right away, and then as they were on their way, because this was a fair distance away, we started using some of the viewer pictures once we could verify what was going on. So it does happen. I mean, the G20 was an excellent example, but we do it all the time on a smaller scale in a local newsroom. Now, in her research, Blanchett-Nelly examined CBC and its foray into participatory journalism and found a measure of success in using citizen input during the news coverage of the G20 summit. She determines by curating citizen material, mainstream networks can be more confident that content will be suitable for air. And I'd concur that's what the CTV Calgary newsroom maintains, the role of curator in collaborative storytelling. Now, currently the collaboration is often restricted to video and photographs offered by our viewers, curated by journalists, as well as comments on the website, again curated by journalists. And we also use Facebook, Twitter, all these social media to gather sources for our stories. But again, we are curating that. I would suggest that this collaborative storytelling is a work in progress, hence the reason we're here. There is certainly a heightened awareness and responsiveness to our viewers, and I think it's a good thing. It helps to ensure the role of the traditional newsroom evolves to incorporate the new media landscape. However, I think we are neither ready nor willing to relinquish our role yet as curators. Because after all, at the end of the day, when CTV Calgary puts a story to air on our website or on Twitter, it is up to us within that newsroom to ensure the information is fair and accurate. I would certainly suggest the speed at which information can be disseminated is unprecedented. There's numerous methods of delivery. But as Mr. Scott alluded to, someone still has to check the facts. And so far in the newsroom, I work in at least, that continues to be the role of the traditional journalist. So the question we were asked to look at in these presentations was, where do we go from here? I see a number of ways. One of the policy issues to be considered, I believe, in this conference, I think this afternoon, is the issue of journalism and making money. I work for a private business, and part of the motivation in this business is to make a profit. I don't think it's unreasonable to expect the corporate world to look for ways to make money while engaging in new media ecology. Other than that, that's really quite beyond my purview. I mean, I'm there collecting a paycheck. But I do think we need to consider that and consider how we can engage citizens, use their input without sacrificing quality and still finding a way to be profitable, or certainly to, as Groundwire was talking about, at least have enough money to run their shows. So there's a number of avenues individual journalists can explore. And as a journalist in a local newsroom, I do cultivate my sources through conversations, opinions, social media, and this is just a small thing, but I think it sort of maybe illustrates our mindsets changing a little bit. The other night I was tweeting what one of my, I do a lot of medical stories, what my story was coming up, and I was just sort of giving people, you know, that 140 characters. It was about the Gardasil vaccination for boys. So a lot of people weighed in with opinions and questions. And what was good about that was it made me contemplate, what am I putting in my story? So as a result of those tweets and some of the questions that I actually had not addressed, I added information. And I verified it through credible sources, but it was not information I had initially planned to include. So I like to think, and I believe, that Twitter interaction did shape my story. And recently, I don't know if this is a form of collaborative storytelling or just bad parenting. I gave a camera to my teenagers. I gave my three teenagers a handy cam, and I asked them to interview themselves and others, and we were doing a series on mental health issues in teenagers, and I wanted them to talk to each other about stress and anxiety. So they did all the interviews, they did all the B-roll, and I think it was easier to offer this kind of amateur-looking video because of this idea of collaboration. Probably 10 to 15 years ago, if I had tried this, you know, I'm sure there would have been people in the newsroom going, this is bad quality, we're not putting that on air. But it was easier, and people were more willing to consider this, and the audience was ready to receive this kind of participation. Now, ultimately, I did make the final decision on what pieces of video would be used for the story. So I remain the curator. However, I think I want to try a little bit more of that, experimenting a little bit more with handing over the camera and letting people ask their own questions. Because, of course, the kids ask different questions and ask them in a different way than I would. So I hope it was a success. And as a mother, I try not to embarrass the kids too much. As an individual journalist, I think we can initiate and champion those new and different ways of presenting news. We need to consider ways of fostering citizen journalism that'll actually make it to our TV webcasts, website, or Facebook. So not just simply using the viewer video to augment our traditional treatment of the story, but to actually support citizen contributions that stand on their own merits. That will take some time from us. That will also take some resources. So, I mean, that's obviously a challenge. But, and not to sound too corny, but this collaborative storytelling, as I think about it, allows me to renew my respect for the viewer. Sometimes you guys, whoever have worked in newsrooms, you know there's some derogatory terms thrown around sometimes about the citizen. But if we start to listen, we are actually going to improve our product, our stories, because we are, it's more now than ever, engaging in a conversation rather than delivering one-way communication. So I believe we can facilitate that. And audiences, as we all know, have always been stakeholders, but now more than ever, we cannot dismiss them. We cannot underestimate their value. We can also not underestimate our own values. We bring skills to the table. They bring information and perspectives, and we need to figure out how to marry them. So if this all plays out well, we can all benefit. And I liked what Professor Washburn, I believe, said. He said our role now is to engage, educate, and empower. And hopefully going forward, that is what we'll do. Thank you so much for your time.
Good morning. My name is Karen Wersig, and I work with the Canadian Media Guild, which is a union that represents about 6,000 media workers across Canada, including workers at CBC Radio-Canada outside of Quebec, and TVO, Aboriginal People's Television Network, Canadian Press, Reuters, a bunch of other broadcasters I won't name now, but they're all there. And I'm joined today by Kathy Edwards, who's from the Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations, which is a national group of people who both run and are interested in community television. So we decided to work together on this presentation out of a concern for the real loss of quality local media, especially in smaller communities, but also within larger centers where, I hate to use the word marginalized, but let's use it for short form, marginalized populations don't necessarily see themselves reflected in mainstream journalism. So that's what we want to talk today about a little bit, is broadening the collaboration between public media and community media, especially in those places that are not particularly well served by media at this point in time because of all the changes. But I first wanted to just salute the students who've been involved in the strike here in Quebec. I know there's some of you in the room, and what I think is great about what's going on is that you guys are broadening the debate about democratic participation, what thinking is about, and it's very exciting. And for somebody who organizes and mobilizes workers in the media industry, I think it's very inspiring to think about that and to think about what possibilities you open up for the rest of us. So thank you very much for doing that. Just flip through. Public media. So when we wrote our paper, somebody asked us, you never define what public media and community media are. So we should just start out by saying that the Broadcasting Act actually defines three sectors in at least broadcasting, which for now includes radio and television in this country: the private sector, the public sector, and the community sector. So CBC, Radio-Canada, is a representative. It's a publicly owned and mandated entity that provides media services. TVO would also be considered a public broadcaster, although it's also qualified as a provincial educational broadcaster, but it's owned and operated by the government of Ontario. Télé-Québec would be another example. Community media is a community-owned and administered entity that teaches media skills and produces and distributes media services. Community members participate directly in the production and administration in community media. So our thesis is that diverse local media is essential to democracy, but the public policy in Canada has failed to support a healthy media system, especially locally. And there's not enough awareness of the value of collaboration among practitioners of public and community media of how that could actually be improved by working better together. So here are some examples of the public policy failure that we covered in our paper. Funding to CBC, which dropped precipitously in the 90s, really never to recover, and precipitated the closure of the closing down of a lot of local programming and innovative programming. On the community end of things, the CRTC held a hearing in 2010 and said no to supporting properly independent community television. Instead, what exists in Canada is about seven, outside of Quebec, about seven truly independent community license holders across the whole country. Right? Is it seven? And then a bunch of cable company-owned media, which are not exactly public access, although they have a public access element to them, but they're owned by huge corporations, right? So the CRTC said, no, let the cable companies keep the money and do what they want with them in terms of their local programming in 2010. And then on the private end, we have, it's hard to see here, this chart is on our website if you're interested in it, outrageous ownership concentration in private media. So what that chart shows on the left side, the Cable Plus guys, it's Bell, Shaw, Quebecor, and Rogers, and then underneath Canada's largest radio network. So this is the state of play when we wrote the paper in February. Since then, things have gotten worse. CBC funding cuts will bring it back to the level close to the bottom of where funding was in the 1990s, when the major cuts when major cuts started to happen. The CRTC said no yet again to community media in March, refusing to offer a final small bit of money from the cable sector into truly independent community media. And ownership concentration is increasing yet again by the announced purchase of Astral Media by Bell. So now we're really going to have four major private broadcasting companies in Canada, which puts us three mergers away from an effective monopoly. And in case that sounds crazy, there were three major mergers in the last 3 years alone. So I would not expect this to be the last one. And I don't think the CRTC will do anything about it, except unless we push to mitigate the effects of this concentration. And so one of the things we want to talk about is the fact that community and public media participation, if it's properly funded and properly considered, could actually be an antidote to what's happening on the ground in local communities. So why these partnerships? Both have public service mandates. They answer to Canadians as citizens first and consumers second. and they have the potential to improve the quality, quantity, and diversity of local media. And it's really the diversity side that we want to think about. It's great what Robert Washburn was talking about earlier in those hyperlocal sites. What this could do is build on the hyperlocal sites to produce an even greater diversity of media voices in smaller communities by working together and producing more than can exist when everybody just works alone. So Kathy's going to come up and talk about the models that we worked out for collaboration and some case studies.
So Karen and I first started working together when we started talking about the digital transition and the fact that there was a potential that CBC over-the-air transmitters, of which there's over 600 in Canada, might be shut down and decommissioned, and whether I thought that communities might be interested to take over the maintenance of them, not just to keep the CBC going potentially, but to use the towers and sites to provide a wireless rural broadband, so to take a crack at the rural broadband challenge that Canada has, to enable the towers to be used for independent community broadcasting, because the cable model, as Karen mentioned, we grew up with Wayne's World, like cable community channels, but we haven't seen them for a decade now operating in that way. Possibly to use them for cellular services. So a lot of infrastructure that's spotty or missing in rural areas, these towers could be repurposed for, in addition to potentially keeping CBC available over the air. So that's how we started chatting. And as over the months approaching the digital transition last summer, we realized that we were both, for a long time, had questions in our minds about, are there ways in this tough media climate for serving local communities where the public sector could collaborate with the community sector more, so not necessarily just with tower sharing, but are there other ways, collaboration could help generate more diversity of local media? So the three models, our research paper is exploratory, really. It raises questions and it looks at particular media challenges in particular markets or communities, if you like, and how those models, either people are already taking stabs at collaboration, failing, succeeding, and what those models are. So the first one I just mentioned is about sharing transmission infrastructure. So the big news 2 weeks ago, of course, is that the CBC is planning to turn off 600 analog transmitters on July 31st. That's infrastructure worth tens of millions, at least, paid for by taxpayers in an enormous heritage project in the 70s to link Canadians coast to coast. It's actually going to cost CBC to cart those towers and decommission them. We're saying surely they could be used by communities to maintain the services that are there already, but also to address problems like rural broadband. And the interest of Cactus in particular, and some of our members already do this, they maintain their own towers in small communities that don't have historically didn't have cable providers. And they already rebroadcast services into their communities with a community channel, a community channel owned and operated by the community. So many of our members are already doing this model, and we want to see that the message gets out to other communities about to lose CBC service and maybe their tower infrastructure that, hey, that's very important, valuable infrastructure. Do you know what else you could do with that tower? And we want to get the message out so that people have an option and can act before July 31st. So that would be the big news since we wrote our paper. But that's just one model of sharing that's relatively, it's just about infrastructure. It doesn't speak to content of community and public broadcasters. The two other models that we talked about, Model B, is in smaller communities that, for example, couldn't possibly support its own CBC local news bureau, but where a community model might be possible because it leverages volunteer and citizen input, of course, could there be collaboration to share facilities, equipment, and maybe even personnel? And there's two ways that model could work. Either there's, there might be a shared studio, a mobile, all the expensive infrastructure for television. I work more on the television side, so I was coming at this more from the expensive television side, preparing it. They could share some infrastructure but still have separate licenses. So you might have a CBC channel broadcasting from that place as well as a community channel, but they share some of the infrastructure to make it possible. Or it could be an affiliate model. So, for example, there might be CBC network content but local community content and generated from that same place too. Model C is that there could be sharing of content, personnel, and production methodologies, but the CBC might not have a presence in smaller communities. So, for example, in communities that they might feel can support a community television channel, and many of our members operate in very small communities, so 500 households and fewer, they're managing to run television channels. So they would hold the license, own the facility, but collaboration could occur in that CBC might access or source some of the content, so it would give the CBC access to more diversity of content, more diversity of viewpoints, because of course it's being created by citizen volunteers, community-run organizations, and the gains to the community channels might be greater exposure for their work, seeing their communities and issues covered on regional and national media, as well as exposure to CBC methods of operation. There might even be internships, you know, where there's an exchange where the CBC would explain, you know, these are the kinds of things that we would need, and cross-fertilization of ideas, because, you know, citizen content coming in will, as Karen mentioned, change the understanding of CBC regional and national bureaus about what's really going out in the field. So we see it as a potential for two-way collaboration. So then we looked around the country. We already knew about places where there had been complaints or perceived deficits in coverage in local media. And so we tried to think about where these models could be applied or people were already trying to apply them. And most of these are not fait accompli, so they're in some middle process right now, so it's a good time to be looking at them. The examples of the potential for sharing towers, transmitters, and frequencies, I've described. Two communities that are taking leadership on this is Kamloops. So, for example, they lost their OTA CBC service in 2006, and there's been a Save Our CBC movement ever since to bring it back and make it available over the air in Kamloops again. And with the CRTC ruling in late 2010 when Shaw bought Global, that Global is being asked to share its signal and tower space with local broadcasters, we've actually spoken to Global and they've indicated, you know, they're willing to honor this. And there's the potential to, for example, run the CBC in Kamloops and maybe a community channel as well as sub-channels on the Global signal. So, you know, part of our information campaign is to let communities know that, you know, this is even a possibility. Most people just don't know. These decisions happen and who knows. The second community that's being very proactive is London, has had a Facebook site going, what's it called, Digital London, since last year when there was the potential that London would lose its over-the-air CBC. And they're talking about a similar idea. Could we keep the CBC going by maintaining that transmitter? I believe it's on a TVO tower, actually, at the moment. It's not a separate tower site. But keep that going. If we upgrade the transmitter ourselves to digital, could we add a community service and multiplex the CBC with the community service? So they're exploring this model and how it might look. And we'd like to have more communities enter this group, but it's an issue of getting the information out. An example of Model B, Hamilton is the largest Canadian city with no CBC radio or TV presence at the moment. Although there's a plan in the works right now, there's going to be a mobile online experiment opening this spring, which hasn't been affected by the budget cut. We didn't know if it would. And the history there is kind of interesting. There is very active community media in the area. The factory in Hamilton is a very active video cooperative, and there's also two college and university community radio channels. And the city, because they've been working for a long time, and there's actually the Center for Community Studies been trying to attract the CBC to Hamilton, initial conversations about what the CBC presence might look like there, the city actually coordinated meetings between Mohawk College and the city to sit down and think about whether they could share studio space in downtown Hamilton. And it came to an impasse because they were talking about having a shared service, so the Model B I was talking about, and there was an impasse about, you know, who's going to have control over prime time, and it kind of fell apart. So in the meantime, we're going ahead with the CBC is going ahead with a mobile online experiment, and the community is hopeful that'll fill their needs. Everyone's in a wait and see approach. So for now, that isn't a public-private partnership, but there's nothing to stop citizen journalism or a community element evolving as we move forward. In Kingston, there's been a perceived decline in the quality of local journalism, particularly at the Whig Standard. There's been, I think, about two-thirds of staff have been laid off since the purchase by Quebecor. And there's a perception in the city, there's a quote by this local activist, if you want to become an informed local citizen now, you have to work harder than you used to. Citizen journalism is filling some of the void, but it's largely issues-based and contributes to a sense of fragmentation of information and involvement, not cohesion. So we thought that that was a very interesting comment. So people are still, you know, what this person is saying is citizen information is great, but as Karen mentioned, and Sneha, people still do look for traditional media to sort of pull it together for them, perhaps, and be the sense makers. So back to Model B, the CBC's presence in both Hamilton and Kingston could be enhanced by collaborating with existing community resources. So right now in Kingston, there is a CBC affiliate. So there's CBC Network content being broadcast from there, and the affiliate produces its own news hours, but there's no actual journalism or bureau that's CBC. So, for example, if they went with an online or experimented with a digital platform, as they're doing in Hamilton, they could enhance that if they were willing to collaborate with parties on the ground. So there's already a university and college-based radio and TV in Kingston, and local video cooperatives that already mobilize citizen content. Interestingly, in Kingston, and this comes back to practitioners in the area seeing the opportunities, when I spoke to Kingston's radio and community television channels, both which have been there for a long time, and said, you know, what do people think about this perceived decline in quality at the WIG standard? And they didn't necessarily see a role for themselves. They didn't think it affected them or touched them. They didn't necessarily see, you know, that's a hole that we could step into, or, you know, we could have part of the solution there. The last Model C, the idea of not necessarily sharing facilities, but methods to share content. We picked a big city example in this case. So Vancouver, which is well served by lots of media, but there's a perception both in the community media side, which is very active but financially fragile, and also there's a perception, of course it depends who you talk to, but there's a perception that the pubcaster may do a very good job at reporting, you know, mainstream issues there, but not necessarily, for example, picking up as quickly as community media on issues affecting the residents of the Vancouver's Lower East Side. So one of the community organizations that has stepped into the gap in terms of trying to address the needs of that community is W2. I don't know how many of you have heard of that. It's they produce a program that airs on Vancouver Co-op Radio in the morning, which is has a very high viewership. And they also produce video content that airs on Shaw Cable. So it's a multi-platform model, but they don't have their own distribution license. And as I mentioned, financing is very fragile. So again, there was an interesting, again, a sort of a city-motivated attempt to try to bring the pubcaster together with community groups more in the redesign of Vancouver's new production facility. There was actually a requirement by the city that some of the space be made available to community groups where the CBC could actually interface with those community groups in some way. That again sort of miscarried. There is a couple of spaces within the CBC facility that were supposed to be used by community groups, but community groups found the rent was just too high. Like good intentions, but miscarried. So a comment by Joan Mellinson, who's an executive producer from CBC Radio in Toronto, stuck in my head from a presentation she did 2 years ago at the Making Media Public Conference in York. She talked about how when they're trying to reach out and deal with sensitive issues in Toronto communities, so for example, domestic violence, I think it was in... Oh, she doesn't have it in this quote exactly what the issue was. But she talks about how they hold town hall-style meetings with particular communities before they to research a story and invite a community in to talk about it before the cameras are ever turned on. And they get agreement from a community about what the approach they're going to take before they start doing interviews. So the community goes away and thinks about it. They decide and commit that they want to work with the CBC on a story. And although it's time-consuming story by story, what Joan was saying is that she's found over time it's very productive because then they get better material. People trust them. They come. They say amazing things on camera. And that's an example of somebody working inside either the public sector or the community sector that's already working using a model that's strong in the other group. So when we look at the situation in Vancouver with Vancouver's Lower East Side, we ask ourselves, well, if the pubcaster doesn't have the reach to get into all these communities, again, could they source content from W2? Could W2 benefit from greater exposure for its content, from financial support if they're sourcing material? So those are the kinds of questions we're looking at. So I mentioned there's been some good intentions but missed opportunities. So the lessons are that both the public and community sectors need to recognize the benefits of collaboration for these initiatives to work, but also that there's public policy support is needed. Both sectors are underfunded currently. Did you want to pick up our recommendations? So the three recommendations we had, one is that obviously we need to stabilize the funding for the CBC, for the CBC to feel it can strike out into new areas. But in particular, we were wondering about a fund which specifically would be available to both the CBC and communities to work together on projects proposed by communities. So it's a grassroots up thing, but then there's resources for both sides to work together. That, like with the CBC, there needs to be adequate financial support for genuinely independent community media centres. There's only 9 in Canada now, actually, because they're expected to rely on ads, so it's a very fragile model. And finally, the immediate big issue for us is that CBC transmission infrastructure that's slated for shutdown should be offered to communities to maintain, and that the benefits can be disseminated in time, and that's a project that Cactus is working on. Thanks very much.
Merci à vous toutes pour ces présentations vraiment très enrichissantes et très, très innovantes. One question that comes to mind just from hearing all of you is how to balance all of this exploration and innovation and reaching out to the public and using all this new technology with something that's going to sound really old-fashioned, but the need for journalistic professionalism and some kind of an authoritative voice. When Karen was talking about handing over the camera, I mean, I'm starting to think of a slippery slope here, but just to play devil's advocate, but you don't have to respond to that directly. It's just kind of to launch the conversation. So if anyone wants to ask, si vous avez des questions, je vous demanderais de demander le micro et de vous identifier, name and affiliation, please. Well, Kai, we know who you are. That's okay.
As a former colleague, I'm really impressed by your trust and bravery in giving your teenagers the video camera. I think that sounds like a really cool experiment. I was wondering if you would ever consider offering a weekend workshop for CTV viewers in Calgary who wanted to learn up their production skills, maybe with professional unionized camera ops. Because the complaint that I've always heard from the technical staff is that the standards drop as soon as you start putting the UGC on the air. But what if there were resources to help train people? Would you be interested in that?
Well, I don't know. Oh, this is on. I don't even know so much if that's necessary now, because our I don't know if you can hear me. Our technology, I believe, is so much more advanced that some of the quality we get now is better than we're used to. And also, one of the points I was trying to make was that I think the audience is more accepting of maybe amateur-looking video. That being said, I like the idea of trying to cultivate and help citizen journalists. And so we don't have to vet everything, but we could. I'd love to pass on skills, absolutely. And so if it's not technical, perhaps it's more of our journalistic standards.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly it, right? Because rather, I'm not talking about resolution or you know, how good the cameras look. There's techniques and visual storytelling that are not necessarily intuitive.
Right,
And there's a huge body of experience within the newsroom. I'm just wondering, you talk about, I mean, there is still an imperative to make a profit, and I don't know if you could work out a fee for a weekend workshop or something, but it is a model that other organizations are doing. I'm wondering if you could find any traction, do you think, within CTV for that kind of I guess, audience capacity building.
I don't know if I personally could or not. I feel like there are people there. I know some of our cameramen have offered workshops in the past, a continuing education on how to shoot. And I think there's a group that are interested in that. I don't want to say, yeah, I'll do it, because you'll hold me to it. But yeah, I think, and we, in CTV, in the bigger picture, Kevin Newman is a big proponent now of using different types of social media to augment our coverage and to get to people in different ways. So I think there is some interest now in the broader network looking at how to collaborate.
Okay.
I hope that answers your question.
Oh, okay. Bob Hackett from Simon Fraser University. Thank you for your thoughts on the technology and on the relationship between amateur citizen journalists and professionals, which is an interesting subject in itself. But I'd like to hear more comments on the themes that were raised in yesterday's plenary panel about the broader relationship between journalism and power, about how what kind of organizational models, and I think Kathy and Karen have started to address this, but maybe more explicitly address what sorts of organizational models could shift the balance of power between those elites that are driving us to global destruction and the social movements trying to prevent and come up with an alternative. That was, after all, the question that was raised yesterday, right? Seriously. So can you address, I mean, technology is fascinating, but what about power?
Yeah, absolutely. When we talk about what bothers me about Joan Melanson's quote, and she's a member and we love her, and she's doing great things, but what bothers me a little bit about that is it's what I would call a voluntarist approach, which is we're the paid professionals. We decide what story we're going to cover, and we'll go out and choose what community we're going to talk to. We'll define what that community is and see if they want to work with us. What I think is really necessary and what we approach in our piece is you actually need a community partner that has its own source of independence and power in this relationship. Probably never going to be as powerful as the big elephant, the CBC, in this relationship, but at least has a fighting chance, right? And so just being able to go out and one-off choose what community I want to talk to today and how I'm going to define that community is not good enough. I would say mainstream media needs actual community partners if they're going to change the power dynamic. And that's one of the things, I mean, community television and community media hubs bring us a lot of things, but including, I mean, as we all know as professionals, they are where people come up in our industry, right? They figure out that they want to work in the industry, they get some experience on the ground. I mean, it's all, that sector does a lot for us. But what it also does is innovate in its own way and challenge power very clearly in the media sector. And so I would say that that's probably the most important element of our paper, which is to say that it's not good enough for mainstream media to go out and choose the communities it's going to work with. It has to be those communities that say, we want a piece of this, we want to tell some stories that other people will see, and let's work together to make it happen. And we think that that is like the key element, and the reason is because of those power dynamics that Bob's talking about.
Actually, the power dynamics could actually be a challenge to installing that kind of a system, but it's a great project. I'm not sure which order, but let's try to kind of diversify as much as possible. Okay. Who's talking?
Oui, moi j'ai une question pour Chantal Franque. Je m'appelle Nicole Robichaud et je travaillais à CBC en 2009 quand la convergence a commencé. Puis peut-être comme vous, peut-être comme moi, vous préférez la radio parce que beaucoup de vos exemples, comme avec des artistes sonores, et Guillermo Gomez Peña et Coco Fusco, viennent de la radio. Je voulais savoir si vous aviez des idées comment réimaginer la télé ou les télénouvelles.
Mm-hmm. En fait, vous l'avez dit, c'est ça, je viens de la radio. Je suis vraiment une fille de la radio. Puis pour moi, ce qui était troublant, c'était d'avoir à abandonner tous ces réflexes pour faire de la télé. Mais mes collègues télé pourraient mieux répondre à votre question que moi. Moi, j'ai des bonnes idées pour l'audio, mais l'image, c'est tellement fort, c'est tellement puissant que je suis pas sûre que tu as besoin d'avoir tant d'idées. T'sais, tu peux la distribuer sur toutes les plateformes, ça parle ça parle, c'est éloquent, une image, tandis que l'audio, tu peux travailler plus avec ça, mais c'est juste ça que je peux dire maintenant. Je m'excuse.
Oh. Hi, my name is Joanne Penhale, and I work as a freelance journalist. And one of the reasons that I work as a journalist, and I think journalism is important, is that that social movements and political movements are explained and contextualized so that people understand when conflicts are happening, and also so that democracy can can be challenged and strengthened by holding people who abuse power accountable. And I have two questions related to social media. One of them is for Sneha, and I wondered if you considered in your research how tweeting and social media might be barriers to good journalism. And my second question is for Kathy. When you're talking about collaboration with the Canadian Media Guild, to what extent have you guys already collaborated with or are prepared to collaborate with other people that are doing what could be considered journalism, and it could be any number of things, blogging and open source software creators and this kind of thing.
Hello? Oh, there we go. Thank you so much for the question. I think two ways I could answer that. From a personal experience as a journalist, as a barrier to good journalism, I think certainly incorporating social media or trying to make the time to talk on social media with people about the story I'm working on or what I'm doing at the moment, it's definitely another deadline or time constraint. So I think that's one of the challenges, is being active. Because I said, you know, for social media, you need to be social. And it's easy for me to say, watch my story at 6 or watch my story. This is what I'm going to be reporting on. But I think it's actually being active, trying to find people who are talking about the same subject I'm reporting on. So that can be a barrier I see as to good journalism, because I still need to be going out there to get my interviews. I need to be making time to edit, write the script, but still I want to be active. So it's I think it's a time, for me it's figuring out how to be more effective with time management than I already am. So that I think is a barrier. In terms of citizens who are on, you know, who are tweeting, I think for media organizations, it has to go beyond the token inclusion of social media. And here's a quick snapshot of what people tweeted about. A lot of us do that, and you know, the organizations I've worked for, I'd say we're guilty of it. As a quick snapshot, here's 5 tweets. I don't think that really displays what people are talking about or the social media aspect, and I think that's something we still have to work on, because there's just so much information and we're always running to meet deadlines. So I think those are still challenges out there.
Hello. So in terms of collaborating with other groups, so we're called CACTUS, the Canadian Association of Community Television Users and Stations. It makes a nice acronym, CACTUS. But the evolution is from Canadians that were and have been over the last decade upset with the fact that Canadian citizens' window on broadcast TV has closed in the last decade, and that there used to be recognition that people had a right to participate in television production and learn about it, and we had this cable community television model. 80% of Canadians got cable. You know, it wasn't bad. A lot of people got training on it. So that was our genesis. But, you know, one of the problems with that model, too, is it's still just on cable and it's still just video. It's not leading citizen media and integrating integrating media. So we still have the word television in the title because, I mean, you can argue about it. It picks up on Chantal's comment about how powerful the image is. Video is often also the most difficult medium for the average person to master and put in their toolbox, in their media literacy skills toolbox. So we still believe that we think that what there needs to be in every community, you can think of it as a core resource like a library, is a community media center where you can go and learn multimedia. So you could learn radio skills if that's your preference. It could be video. It could be basic web skills and how to integrate those for nonprofits, for small businesses, for individuals. How do you get messages out using all of these tools, even the most challenging ones that, you know, the corporate media has access to? And so although we still have television in the name, really what we're advocating is community media centers that have distribution on all these platforms, so including mainstream television broadcast licenses. So W2 doesn't have to rely on Shaw to distribute its programs. It can have its own license on the internet, on mobile platforms. So we intervened in the spectrum auction last year to argue that there should be public space in that spectrum auction so that public entities can get access to mobile space as well. So it's an argument you have to make on all the platforms all the time. And yes, we want partners. So when I heard Robert Washburn talk about the hyperlocal internet portal this morning, I mean, we want to partner with him. We need groups in communities to come forward and ask for these CBC transmitters. That's exactly what we're looking for.
So we have time for one more question only.
Both of them have spoken. Okay.
Let you fight them.
Well, a little bit on following on, I wanted to ask Sneha and Karen to cast their minds back to this morning's panel, where we heard from Bob Hackett and Pinar Gurleven, and they talked about, you know, these new ideas, these new forms requiring, I think they said something like changes in, you know, the focus on timely events in favor of processes, changes in daily news routines. And when I heard you talking, I was, you know, seized with the idea that, you know, things are just accelerating. You have to move faster and faster and faster to keep on top of things. You have less and less time to think, and you have this demand to be current and urgent and doing all this stuff all the time. And I just kind of wondered, is there any, you know, potential synthesis between those two things? I mean, do you see what they're talking about as possible at all in your jobs, in your working lives? So, yeah.
That's a very good question. I think in terms of, I definitely feel that there is this need to speed things up, and that's what I've experienced with social media and my own attempt to try and include it more in my work. I think definitely there is this sense of the, I always refer to it, I want it now. And, you know, every day, if I go and personally visit 6 news websites a day, I know, you know, everyone has their sites they want to visit. Why not make news, whether it's online, whether it's on television or print, well, I guess more online than anything, but on 24-hour news channels. I think it's all right to be using information, some user-generated content, some professional content, and trying to, and I think viewers are okay with you saying, this is what we have now, we're working on it, and that idea that we're constantly working on the product, it doesn't always have to be the polished, final, edited, professional piece, and I think I like that, and I think it's a good movement to be part of that idea of, here's what we're doing now, we're going to keep trying to add to the story, as opposed to always waiting for the final product. Although I do like documentaries in the final product as well. I think there's a great space for them.
Well, and also I think the viewers, our viewers, are looking at local news for that timely subject matter. They do want to know if the highway's closed. That's where they're that's why they're gravitating to the local news. We actually do offer programming on CTV2. It's called Primetime. It offers us a different venue for much longer pieces, thoughtful interviews. So I don't know if we as local news can be all things to all people, and I think our sense in our newsroom is that our mandate, like what Mr. Washburn's been quoted a lot, but that hyper-local news is so important to our community, just so they feel informed with what is going on in their community. And I don't know right now if local news has the opportunity to dig as deep and go to as many layers. We don't have that kind of format right now. There can always be change. I know CBC in Calgary has tried many permutations. Some have worked, some have not, but they've tried to. So, I mean, hopefully we are still all open to changing our product to suit not ourselves so much, but the citizen.
I just want to add something about Converge Newsroom. Converge Newsrooms. What seems to emerge in some newsrooms is a two-speeds journalism, you know, so there is this elite group who have time to do long stories, and meanwhile there's this more like a manufacturer like team that feeds the beast, and the only worry about that is that people who are feeding the beast rely a lot on PR material, so yeah.
Aptly said. Je vais vous demander d'aller chercher votre lunch et de revenir vous asseoir ici parce qu'on va avoir une table ronde pendant le dîner. So please get your lunch and come back and sit in the room so we can hear the talk during lunch.